first episode of the VHIA Weekly Update. We'll be utilising this video cast and podcast on a regular basis to explore key issues for the industry on a more in-depth basis. Joining me today is Tim Nagel, Principal Consultant with VHIA, and today's topic will be the Safe Patient Care Act. Welcome, Tim.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Stuart. On the first podcast, it's great.
It's an auspicious occasion, and we have an auspicious date coming up, namely the 23rd of December 2016. Tim, could you describe the significance of that particular date?
Yes, it was on the 23rd of December 2015 that the Safe Patient Care Act was passed and came into operation. So the first anniversary is soon coming up.
So given that we have a first anniversary, we should mark it. I bought a cake. It's not a particularly spectacular cake, but we'll, unfortunately for occupational health and safety reasons, I understand we cannot light the candle. But that shouldn't prevent us from discussing the Safe Patient Care Act in a bit more detail. The Safe Patient Care Act had a period of 12 months grace, which allowed people to operate below ratio until that first anniversary. And given that first anniversary is coming up, we now have quite a lot of activity in order to ensure that members are compliant with that legislation. There are three key areas I'd like to talk to you about where the issues for compliance are perhaps most pressing, namely midwifery, those with above ratio arrangements, particularly those people who are granted additional EFT through bargaining rounds, and those with below ratio CWMA. I just was wondering if you could set out for members some of the activities you've been undertaking in order to progress those issues, particularly with regards to the ANMF.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of work that's gone into preparing for the 23rd of December. That's involved initially at the start of the year, surveying members to seeing where they were at and what the issues were that they had. And we redid that recently, I think it was about August. So we've been meeting with the ANMF throughout October and also November to try and get a joint understanding of some of the challenges that exist around that 23rd of December date and what needs to occur to facilitate members being compliant with the Act on that date. So what we've come up with is a series of agreed positions and templates to facilitate that.
The development of agreed templates with the ANMF and the significance of that, that these are not items that members need to use and wonder as to whether or not they will be acceptable. These are developed templates that people can rely on in order to give effect to some of those key areas for compliance.
And that was a key outcome for members, is to have something that they'll be able to use reliably, knowing that it will be an acceptable format and the ANMF will be familiar with it, and that will expedite the process of approving those, or at least the ANMF considering those.
Can we start with midwifery in terms of the issues that arise from midwifery in terms of the Act and the need for local agreements to support existing arrangements? And in particular, that there are a couple of issues that arise from the legislation, including the impact of midwife to patient ratios for those registered nurses who are undertaking postgraduate studies and working in post or antenatal units. Could you talk to that issue just a little bit and explain to people how that issue has arisen and what the steps are to resolve it?
Yeah, so in terms of, as we know, previously registered nurses have been in their own division of the Registry Act, and midwives have got their own. But what has happened is that historically there has been registered nurses working in midwifery for a long period of time. But because of the introduction of the Act and the distinction between the midwife to patient ratios and the nurse to patient ratios, they aren't technically counted within those ratios. So the first step is to identify that group and to enter into a local arrangement whereby they can be counted into the arrangement. So that's the first sort of section. The second section is, and it's along the same lines, is that employers have a process where there's postgraduate studies in midwifery, so current registered nurses who want to become midwives enter into an employment arrangement with employers to undertake that postgraduate midwife study. So what would happen if you just went by the letter of the legislation is that they wouldn't be counted in the can within the numbers, but that has all sorts of unforeseen consequences on employers' abilities to create a workforce to work in midwifery. So what we've done is that we've, in consultation with the ANMF, is that we've developed a template to enable that model to continue. The positives about that template is that it also considers the local arrangements both within the hospital and also within the university curriculum.
So I think it's important for members to understand that the continuation of the registered nurse undertaking postgraduate studies in midwifery and the use of that model in post and antenatal units is something that's supported by everyone, that's supported by our members, supported by the ANMF and the department, and everybody wants it to continue.
It's critical that it continues. This is a big feeder into the midwifery workforce, so it's critical for everyone that that model is able to continue under the Safe Patient Care Act legislation.
Tim, you referred to another category of employee, and that is where perhaps for historical reasons a registered nurse may be working in a midwifery area. How have the discussions with regards to employees in that category gone?
It's really important that that those people with that experience and that knowledge aren't displaced from those areas where their clinical expertise is. So again, we need a process to ensure that there's technical compliance with the Act, and that will be in the form of a local arrangement. So all the parties agree is that those people should continue in their preferred clinical areas, but we just need a mechanism to ensure the compliance with the Act at the same time.
So the significance of that being that nobody is seeking to displace employees who are registered nurses working in those particular areas.
That's right, exactly right.
You referred before to a local agreement, and just for the benefit of those people who may not be familiar with that term, what we're talking about there is something, a mechanism under the legislation as opposed to simply the ordinary use of the term local agreement.
Yes.
In terms of the factors that are necessary to establish a local agreement, are you able to... There are a number of factors I understand that a local agreement must address, including a range of considerations and the like. There is some degree of formality, but it doesn't require that it be lodged with, say, the Fair Work Commission.
No, so the benefits of a local agreement is the informality of the agreement. So the Act or the regulations prescribe some considerations that need to be addressed, and they're all outlined in the template, so that members won't have to go to legislation to find what those considerations will be. They'll be actually ingrained into the template itself. And other things like, so who's affected, what area is affected, and also a time that the agreement lasts for are all important parts in that local agreement. So the benefits of it really is that there's no formality, there's no lodging, it can be done between the parties, there'll be a template, and it will be able to give effect to some of the things that we want as an outcome.
Is there a good faith requirement with regards to reaching a local agreement?
In terms of good faith, there is. So there's a requirement for the parties to negotiate in good faith around that agreement. And certainly the ANMF in discussions to date have more than lived up with that good faith requirement. But it needs to be at the local level that good faith also needs to be demonstrated.
In terms of the considerations that a local agreement must address, if I just go through them very quickly, they are the you must address the impact on the quality of patient care, the profile of the patients, including age and expected length of stay, complexity of treatment, capacity to complete duties within rostered hours, clinical risks, including risks of falls and ulcers and the like, occupational health and safety, and engagement from staff. As a list of considerations, that sounds extraordinarily familiar.
It does. So you'll be referring to those are from the previous course 42. There's some of the considerations used in that. I mean, it's a bit of a unique situation in terms of this process, in that what we're doing is trying to seek to preserve the status quo. So a lot of the considerations is around how the models have been working previously and will continue to operate in the future.
So to draw a distinction between some of the Clause 42 proposals that were a feature of the last agreement, which were proposals made to implement a change, these proposals for local agreements are about preserving the status quo. And I guess the key difference between implementing a change and preserving the status quo is that you can say with a degree of certainty what the impact on the considerations will be.
That's exactly right. So this isn't about really guessing or not guessing so much, but sort of speculating about what the perceived benefits will be. These are actual outcomes that are already known that we want to continue.
And in terms of the templates that have been developed and are in the process of being settled, which will soon be distributed to members, they include responses to those considerations, I understand?
Yes. So but there's all the criteria addressed in the template. So it really is about, I mean, there will be some local considerations that will need to be factored in, but the template sets it all out for them.
There's another category with regards to midwifery that it's worth touching on, and that's with regards to registered midwives in special care nurseries, and in particular those who might rotate through a special care nursery. That's been a subject, I understand, of discussion with the ANMF as well.
Yeah, so in terms of direct entry midwives, there are some concerns about looking after really sick babies. So those discussions are progressing at the moment. There is nothing stopping a employer proposing a local agreement that will address that situation, but we're really looking at trying to have a agreed process around that. So that's subject to a couple of further discussions that will occur this week and early next week so that we can get that finalised. But there is nothing stopping people using the local agreement template in the interim.
So in terms of the materials that members can expect to see once they are finalised with the ANMF, in effect, it will be a document that sets out a range of circumstances and templates to support each of those circumstances.
Exactly right. And the bulletin itself will outline how they can be used.
And in terms of the use of those templates, where a member does propose a local agreement, is that something that you would like VHAA to have a record of from our perspective?
So the template includes a copy being sent to the VHAA. We would like to continue to support members in this area. So from our perspective, it would be useful to be looped into that process from the start.
So in terms of midwifery services, notwithstanding that there are some practices and the Act that don't necessarily marry up, there is general support to ensure that there is no disruption with respect to RNs who are undertaking postgraduate training or who have historical practices that are appropriate, but it is necessary to have a local agreement in order to preserve those practices.
Correct. Correct.
And members will be provided with a template local agreement which they can rely on in order to give effect and to continue those practices before the first birthday of the legislation.
Exactly, yes.
In terms of other items that arise, we were talking before about those who have an above ratio CWMA. Just in terms of the meaning of the term above ratio CWMA, it's quite confined.
Yes, it is. So the Act sets out the requirements for above ratio CWMA, and to sort of condense it down, it's those EFT that have been allocated either through the 2008 300 EFT allocation. VHIA have sent out letters to health services, I think, within the last couple of months, and also at the end of last year, I think, from memory, just outlining what those allocations were. And also other allocations such as resuscitation nurses that have occurred over time. So this, the above CWMA seeks to preserve those allocations for within health services.
So just in terms of CWMA, it does sound like the worst village people song ever. But that term CWMA, where does it come from?
So the CWMA definition was included in the agreement. So it's contained in the 2012 agreement. I believe it's been included in every agreement since 2000. It was initially, the purpose of it was to preserve from the Blair decision around the implementation of the ratios to preserve those employers who didn't have those obligations created through that 2000 Blair decision. So, so it is a familiar term for health services.
So current workload management arrangement, as I recall it, under the EBAs had the effect of preserving a staffing arrangement at a particular point in time, either below or above ratio. The way that the legislation operates in terms of an above ratio CWMA is a much more confined notion, much narrower notion than the one that was under the EBA previously.
That's right, it's really confined to that additional 300 EFT and additional resuscitation nurses, etc., as opposed to anything above that.
So the additional EFT that was granted in 2008, that was some 300-odd EFT assigned to not only particular health services, but particular wards and particular shifts. Now, 2008 is more than one year ago. It's now 8 years ago.
It is.
And what have you found in terms of the way in which services have altered since that time that might have had an impact on above ratio CWMA?
Look, members will know firsthand the dynamic environment that health services operate within. The sector doesn't stay still, and in fact, it's ever changing. So a lot of the experience with that allocation has been is that there has been reconfiguration of wards and changes in how wards are structured. So that tracking that EFT across those changes over those 8 years has been quite challenging for some.
And in terms of the tracking of that EFT and the discussions with the ANMF about how to give effect to the fact that services and wards may have changed over that eight-year period, how have those discussions gone?
So the ANMF are aware of the challenges for health services in that space and the changes both in terms of structure and also personnel that were involved in those, so that there is a bit of a process of reconciliation that needs to occur. And many health services are doing that to enable them to create that baseline so that they can explain where that additional 300 EFT is for their health service.
And just in terms of when we send out materials with the bulletin that has the templates, what are the procedural aspects that are related to that 300 EFT? What is it that health services need to do in order to give effect to changes that may have occurred since those EFT were first allocated?
Yeah, so the original 2008 allocation letter had a process for that, for health services to change where that EFT was allocated. And many health services have followed that and they have great records about how that's occurred. The issue really is where those records don't exist. So we're going through a process whereby health services seek to reconcile where that additional EFT is. And it's not an easy task. I mean, a lot of health services have got to look through their records and those who were involved at the time. But that will provide a baseline for the above ratio CWMA so that we know that, so that we can get health services to ensure their compliance with the Act. Because it's the preservation of that above 300 EFT that is a challenge that needs to be overcome.
And in terms of, is that an arrangement where the EFT has been reallocated to a different ward that requires a local agreement or some other process?
It could be reallocated to another ward, it could be reallocated to another shift. So, for instance, it was originally allocated on the PM shift, but...
There's a greater need, presumably, on another shift.
Yes, that's right. So, and that, look, that has been arranged with locally with the employees and maybe the ANMF, and that's how it's occurred. So this process seeks to just create a record of that so that that baseline can be established for further compliance checks.
And in terms of, if I can put it in these terms, to cork or not to cork, with regards to the 300 EFT and the way that that additional EFT interacts with the prescribed ratios?
And look, we've spoke to the ANMF about this because this is one of those things that's open to interpretation. So what has come out of those discussions is that if a ward who has been allocated additional EFT is at ratios, then there's no need to put an additional staff member on. If they're below ratios, so there's some rounding required, that needs to be rounded up. So if, for instance, a 30-bed unit who received, say, a medical surgical ward that was 1-4, they would have been allocated an additional EFT to round up from the 50%. That ward needs to always round up, whether they're at 29, whether they're at 30, whether they're at 31, they round up to 32. But if they're at 32, they just need to meet the ratios.
Okay, so that removes... By taking that approach, it removes the incentive to change the bed numbers.
Yeah, so currently there's a perverse incentive to reduce your bed stock down to 31 so that you don't have to put another EFT on. This removes that.
That's a better model, isn't it?
It is much better.
And the other category, I guess, for employers is those who are below ratio, either because of workforce issues or because they had a below ratio CWMA. Are there many employers in that category?
No, there's not. There are some rural health services that continue to have difficulties recruiting staff, and they undertake a range of strategies to try and do that. So that isn't a below ratio CWMA per se. It is more the staff that have historically had haven't been required to recruit to the full ratio quantum. So these are the people with a true below ratio CWA. So those people who are just having recruitment difficulties should continue to try and recruit to those vacant EFT. Those people who have below ratio CWMA arrangements, the 23rd of December is relevant to those people.
So for those people who are having genuine workforce issues and are making those attempts to recruit, in terms of their risk for prosecution under the Safe Patient Care Act?
So the Act acknowledges that where staff are not available, that that is a defence against prosecution. So it's built around making sure that that isn't a basis for prosecution. So they should be feeling secure in that sense. But that's not to say that they shouldn't make every effort to try and recruit to those positions.
Tim, so we're just finalising that bulletin, which will have templates that are attached to it that are relevant to specific circumstances, and we're asking that members utilise those local agreements before the 23rd of December and return copies of those to VHAA?
Yes, we would encourage health services to do them as soon as possible in terms of the completion. But that's the process. So once they get the templates, identify which one is suited to their needs and complete it, return to VHAA.
And if members need additional support?
They can call us at any time if they need any assistance completing the template, or in fact to confirm that the template is the correct process for them to follow.
Okay, so the 23rd of December, here we come. I guess that it's a matter of sharing the cake. Happy birthday. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
This week's Industrial Roundup, we have the Nurses Agreement, which has been lodged with the Fair Work Commission. We're currently awaiting a date for hearing, and once, if that is approved by the Fair Work Commission, it will come into operation 7 days after that date. As soon as that date is known, we will communicate to members the notice of hearing date that we have. With respect to mental health, drafting continues apace. We anticipate that the drafting should be completed through an agreed process by Christmas. There is still the issue of industrial action that is affecting members. There'll be a reference group meeting for the mental health reference group shortly to provide a specific update with regards to that industrial action. The Health and Allied Services Managers and Administrative Workers Agreement has been the subject of a successful ballot. That agreement has now been lodged with the Fair Work Commission, and again, we are waiting for a notice of listing with a date. We will communicate the date for hearing to members as soon as we receive it. The Allied Health Professionals Agreement is now proceeding to ballot. Members will have distributed by now the relevant materials for that ballot process, and we look forward to that closing before too long and that agreement being approved, but we will be providing updates once the ballot date has arrived. With respect to the Medical Scientists Agreement, that agreement had a later nominal expiry date than the other agreements, and as a result, the discussions to replace that agreement are at a much earlier stage. The parties are working through their respective claims, but there'll be further updates with respect to that agreement shortly. With respect to our community health members, the Social and Community Services Agreement is the subject of a counteroffer proposal from the Australian Services Union, which is currently being considered, and there was a meeting of community health members this week to consider a consolidated process by which to advance the expired agreements, including those of allied health professionals and for the medical scientists. Those are the key industrial issues arising in this week. Thank you very much for either listening to or watching this broadcast. We'll be doing this on a regular basis as a way in which to provide more detailed information to members about key subjects, as well as providing a more regular update as to industrial issues that arise during the course of the week. Thank you very much.